Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. Today, we continue our series on Supreme Court decisions by talking about the landmark ruling affecting the country's growing homeless population. The six conservatives on the Supreme Court ruled that cities can fine and arrest homeless people for sleeping in public spaces, even if they have no other place to go. The ruling says criminalizing camping in public does not amount to cruel and unusual punishment under the Eighth Amendment. In her dissent, Justice Sonia Sotomayor wrote, "Either stay awake or be arrested." Vox policy reporter Rachel Cohen writes that the ruling is the most significant legal challenge to the rights of homeless people in decades. The case was brought by Grants Pass, Oregon. Cal Matters reporter Marisa Kendall writes, the case stems from a 2018 lawsuit against Grants Pass, a small city in southern Oregon that banned camping throughout its jurisdiction. The lower courts sided with homeless residents who argued that because humans need to sleep somewhere, the Grants Pass ordinance made it illegal to be homeless. And that is how this case ended up at the Supreme Court. Supporters of Grants Pass's petition included several major cities and counties across the country, 20 Republican-controlled states, the California Police Chiefs Association, California Governor Gavin Newsom, and San Francisco Mayor London Breed. We invited San Francisco Mayor London Breed to join the show. She declined, but she did send us a statement, and we'll read that later in the show. Over 650,000 people in the United States experience homelessness on any given night. Roughly 40% are sleeping outside on the streets, in cars, parks, train stations, and other places. Federal data published late last year showed a rise in homelessness in most states. Here in California, there are 181,000 unhoused people, according to official numbers from the U.S. Department of Housing and Urban Development. That is up nearly 40% from 5 years ago. 40% in just 5 years. Unhoused people in California make up one third of the U.S. homeless population. Cal Matters reports that last year, California cities and counties reported having about 71,000 emergency shelter or transitional housing beds, but it would take more than twice that number to accommodate every unsheltered person today. So where are people supposed to go? How will cities respond to this ruling? Joining us are three guests. Rachel Cohen is policy correspondent for Vox, a general interest news site. In a recent piece about the decision, Rachel writes, Grants Pass v. Johnson does not spell the end to fights over tent encampments. It only concerns what cities can do and not what they should do. Hi, Rachel. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
We're also joined by Marisa Kendall. Marisa covers California's homeless crisis for Cal Matters, a nonprofit news site dedicated to covering the country's biggest state. Hi, Marisa. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Hi, good morning.
Sarah Rankin is a law professor at Seattle University School of Law and founder of the school's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project, which engages law students in legal and policy research and advocacy work to advance the rights of homeless adults, youth, and children. Professor Rankin's California Law Review article on the criminalization of homelessness was cited by Justice Sonia Sotomayor's dissent from the Supreme Court's recent ruling. Hi, Sarah. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, Rose.
Sarah, you recently spoke with The Guardian about this ruling, and you described it as quite possibly the most consequential decision in history up until this point relating to homeless rights. So tell us more just about just how monumental this is.
It's enormously significant. You know, when you think about the Eighth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution, we typically, as lawyers, think of it as sort of the baseline of whether and to what extent we value the humanity and dignity of vulnerable people who are subjected to abuses in the legal system. And so when the lawyers here were using the Eighth Amendment to try and protect people who are unhoused from being fined or jailed for nothing other than being homeless, the hope was that it would be understood that there is some floor to how poorly we can treat already vulnerable people. But of course, the conservative majority decided that cities can jail or fine people for nothing other than being homeless. So it's a really, really a sad decision.
Can you tell us more about the Grants Pass, Oregon case? What else do we need to know about that?
Sure. Grants Pass, of course, is a city in Oregon, and they had a series of civil and criminal ordinances that effectively amounted to a 24/7 ban on public homelessness in their jurisdiction. So parties there argued that the Eighth Amendment prohibits governments from inflicting cruel and unusual punishment on the basis of someone's unavoidable status or being. So that case, and this is really important because it always gets lost, and I imagine it will also get lost in whatever London Breed statement you'll be reading later. It actually has nothing to do with sweeps. Cities have always been able to sweep, and the Johnson case before the Supreme Court reviewed it also did not affect any city's ability to sweep. All it said was that you cannot, if a city lacks shelter, they cannot also jail or fine someone for lacking shelter. So those were the sorts of arguments that the plaintiffs there made. And the conservative majority agreed with Grants Pass. And there were some technical grounds for it. But basically, my read of it is that the conservative majority sort of took a federalism stance, saying, look, this is something that the judiciary doesn't want to get involved in. And city governments and the people are really the experts on how to solve homelessness. So we'll just leave it to them.
And we're going to talk about San Francisco during the show today. Mission Local's Joe Eskenazi writes that San Francisco's, he calls it a very dishonest legal brief, and it helped the United States Supreme Court criminalize homelessness. So we'll discuss that in detail on today's show. But before we do that, Marisa, you cover California's homeless crisis for Cal Matters. Given this monumental decision, what does this now allow cities to do?
Yeah, so before this decision, cities in California generally were interpreting this to mean before we sweep an encampment, we have to make sure we have enough shelter beds to offer everyone who's going to be displaced by this sweep. Now they no longer have to do that. So this allows cities to have a lot more freedom to sweep camps, even if they don't have shelter beds to put people in. And if they choose to do so, they can enact new ordinances criminalizing camping in certain places or throughout the whole city, or they can just use existing ordinances to further crack down and arrest and fine people who are sleeping outside.
So can you just tell us in practice, how do you think this is going to play out based on what you are hearing now from, let's just talk about California and then we can talk about the rest of the country, but what strikes you about what you're hearing from California politicians about how they're going to respond to this?
Yeah, I think it's really too soon to tell. I'm really watching closely to see what impact this will have, because a lot of politicians, especially from the larger, more liberal cities, you know, no one wants to go on record and say out loud, we are going to use this to criminalize homelessness. Mayor Karen Bass down in LA took issue with the decision and said she disagrees with it. She's going to continue her policy of moving folks out of encampments and into hotels. And in San Francisco, you know, as we talked about, Mayor Breed said she's actually going to change, you know, start changing policy, become more aggressive. So I think it really depends on the city. But I think we have to be careful because even in cities where they say on the face, nothing's going to change, we're still going to use our housing first policies, this still gives them the ability to quietly sweep away encampments that maybe they view as troublesome, even if they are not saying that's what they're going to do.
Well, let's talk about San Francisco, and I want to play a clip from Mayor Breed. We invited her to join the show. Her office declined. They sent us a statement. Mission Local's Joe Eskenazi writes that because of the Supreme Court decision, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals overturned an injunction that prevented San Francisco from getting rid of homeless encampments without providing people shelter. Her office, London Breed's office, said in a statement, quote, San Francisco is a city that prioritizes compassion, will continue to lead with services first in all of our outreach efforts, but we cannot allow for people to refuse services and shelter when offered and available. So San Francisco wrote a brief in support of the ruling. And as Joe Eskenazi said, it helped the Supreme Court criminalize homelessness. NBC's Sergio Quintana spoke about the Supreme Court ruling with San Francisco Mayor London Breed and San Francisco City Attorney David Chu.
We will continue to lead with services, but we also can't continue to allow people to do what they want on the streets of San Francisco, especially when we have a place for them to go.
Mayor Breed mentioned the difficulty in dealing with a special kind of problem in the city, people who are offered shelter, even housing, but refuse the offer and continue camping in city streets.
We lead with shelter first, and about 60% of the people we encounter refuse what we're offering, and that's what the biggest problem is. 10% are actually people who are housed.
We've had challenging homeless encampment situations where individuals have refused offers of sheltered services, where someone will just pick up a tent and just move down a block. And this decision will give the city more flexibility to address that.
That was San Francisco Mayor London Breed and San Francisco City Attorney David Chu, who went on to tell NBC that police can cite people again in what he called extreme cases. We'd love to know what extreme cases means, and we'll keep an open invitation with city leaders to talk about this. In her statement, Mayor London Breed said conversations with the city attorney are underway to inform next steps. And I just wonder, Rachel, Marisa, I was struck by what Mayor London Breed said, that 60% of the people refuse shelter. I don't know how they know that 10% of the people are housed, but as you report, there are not enough shelter beds for everyone. And I've also heard a lot of people who are unhoused on the streets who say, you know, I don't want to go into these shelters because you can't bring your things with you, or it's just not safe. There are people screaming throughout the night. I mean, there's all sorts of different reasons. So what are your thoughts about what Mayor Breed said in that clip?
Yeah, no, that's completely right. You know, a lot of folks they get marked as quote unquote service resistant, and people say that they've refused offers of shelter when in reality, it's a lot more complicated. You know, maybe the type of shelter that was offered to them just is not going to work for them. Some people have really severe PTSD from being on the streets or have other mental health issues, and they just cannot be sleeping in a bunk in a room crowded with other people. Or maybe, they don't want to leave their possessions behind, their pets, their partner, or maybe they just don't want to spend a couple nights in a shelter if they know there's no housing opportunity that's going to come out of that. So there are a lot of reasons why people decline shelter. But it is interesting that Mayor Breed is focusing on enforcement against people who decline offers of shelter, because that's not really what this case is about. You know, this case is about allowing cities to crack down against people, even if there is no shelter offered. So it's interesting just the rhetoric that the mayor is using, you know, focusing on this population, when in reality, now they do have the freedom to, make no offers of shelter and still move people along.
Rose, may I comment? This is Sarah.
Yes.
That is exactly what I would have anticipated from Mayor Breed. And Marisa's 100% right on. For her to take the position that what this does is allow them to address the problem that people are declining offers of shelter is entirely disingenuous, because the law before the Supreme Court reviewed the Johnson case never protected people who declined an offer of shelter. So the Johnson decision, Johnson was never about what do we do with people who decline offers of shelter. They were never protected under the prior law. It was only people who would have accepted an offer of shelter or who were involuntarily homeless who were protected. And that's the law that Mayor Breed and others fought to reverse.
Let me ask you a question, another question. And Rachel, I want to bring you in on this, but I think focusing on San Francisco for just a few more minutes is really important. Joe Eskenazi with Mission Local writes that authorities have been allowed to move or dismantle encampments based on three other sections of the penal and health codes. And so Joe Eskenazi is arguing that, you know, Justice Gorsuch cited a San Francisco brief that he said was dishonest. And here's what they cited. Quote, often encampments are found in a city's poorest and most vulnerable neighborhood. With encampments dotting neighborhood sidewalks, adults and kids in these communities are sometimes forced to navigate around used needles, human waste, and other hazards to make their way to school, the grocery store, or work. Judicial intervention, the mayor continues, has led to painful results on the streets and in neighborhoods, Justice Gorsuch concluded. So Joe Eskenazi writes, Gorsuch, and by extension Breed, would have you believe that San Francisco is powerless to prevent every man, woman, and child from asphyxiating in a swamp of needles and feces. But again, it's not necessarily so. He says it's dishonest because the sweeps have been allowed. So can you explain what's going on here, Rachel? Talk about the brief that San Francisco filed, and why do you think that, you know, Gorsuch cited it and then Joe Eskenazi's response saying what San Francisco was doing was not illegal in the first place?
Sure.
Sarah, and then Marisa, do you want to jump in? Sarah?
Oh, I'm sorry. I thought you were posed the question for Rachel.
No. I'm going to bring Rachel in a minute.
I see.
Go ahead, Sarah.
Okay. I'm sorry. Can you repose the question?
Yes. So can you talk about the brief that was used, that was cited in the Supreme Court case? Because, you know, as Mission Local's Joe Eskenazi, he's a longtime journalist in the city, and he writes that this was a dishonest brief. Why is that the case?
They're dishonest briefs because they are trying to play on. It's really, really easy to trigger emotional reactions that are based in fear instead of based in fact. And the cities, as you noted, cities have always been able to sweep, regardless of the Johnson case that they sought to get reversed. The law prior to this didn't stop cities from sweeping encampments. They could have done that before. It also didn't require cities to allow homelessness in every place and at every time. Cities could impose reasonable time planner place and manner restrictions. It didn't stop cities from acting when they were pressing health or public safety issues, and it didn't protect anybody who declined an offer of shelter, as we already discussed. It also didn't require cities to provide adequate shelter. What it requires them essentially to do is to figure out the most compassionate and effective ways to respond to homelessness. So the Johnson case, as I said before, only said, the law before the Supreme Court reversed it only said that if a city lacks shelter, it also cannot also jail or fine an unhoused person for not having shelter. So this whole positioning, this jockeying of politicians saying that they needed this decision to get reversed so that they could actually respond to homelessness, jail and fines are not logical or evidence-based responses to homelessness. They've actually been proven repeatedly to make homelessness worse. So there's all sorts of ways that that it's disingenuous, but among them is the fact that what they're really trying to do is to trigger an emotional reaction. It's much harder to slow things down, give people information, and get a thoughtful reaction.
Rachel, why don't you jump in here? I wanted to spend a lot of time on this to really understand what's happening. Because on its face, people may have thought, oh, so this never was legal before, and now it's legal now. Can you talk more about that?
You think people might have thought it was never legal to
never legal to sweep, or never legal to do what we have seen in California. I'm sorry, in places like San Francisco.
Right. I mean, I think this is an ongoing challenge that jurisdictions throughout the West Coast have been dealing with is you do have cities saying you have advocates, attorneys representing homeless people saying you are violating the terms. You're making it impossible to sleep outside even under the constraints of the law. And they're saying, we're not saying you can't sweep homeless people because that is allowed. But then cities are saying, no, the conditions though make it virtually impossible for us to comply. And so it was this back and forth. And the problem that we have now in this post grants pass world is this is not actually really resolved. We are still going to see a lot of these same fights in cities all across, in the Ninth Circuit jurisdiction, but really you're going to see it across the country because the Supreme Court didn't really resolve anything, but they did essentially take away the argument that it would amount to cruel and unusual punishment to do a sweep. So I think it's such a significant ruling, but it's also not really providing much clarity on a lot of the practical fights that I think we should expect to see.
So can you elaborate on this a bit more? You write that the ruling determines what cities can do, not what they should do.
Yes. So a big focus of mine over the last couple months is, well, what happens if the Supreme Court overturns Grants Pass and Martin v. Boise, which they did, but at the time I didn't know. And so I spent a lot of time talking to folks who want to see cities take a more aggressive approach on clearing encampments and people who, want to see cities step up in their protections and codifying rights for unhoused individuals. And what I meant by that statement is you're going to see pressure on there's been a lot of pressure on leaders already, but we're going to see more pressure because there's going to be people saying, look, now there's no, you don't need to worry about the threat of a constitutional violation like you did last month. So you can be more aggressive here about clearing out encampments or, moving homeless people off the street. But especially in liberal cities where you have, more advocacy groups, more Democratic politicians, maybe more people who don't necessarily want to see that kind of approach, you're also going to have pressure on politicians to not do that, to pass laws sort of preventing that, to look for alternative solutions. So you're going to – leaders have more space to act now in a lot of different directions, and – we're going to see lots of battles playing out over what to do. And part of what you should expect to happen is there are some groups that are right now thinking a lot about, well, how do we make it non-discretionary on local governments to clear out encampments? How do we try to make it so that they can't sort of decide to let encampments stay there, even though they now could more easily clear them out if they wanted to. And that's one of the, I would say, next chapter battles we're going to see in the next couple of years.
Yeah, I think, and I'm sorry if this was confusing, but I just want to make sure that we understand why this made it to the Supreme Court, what this actually means in practice. Because after reading a couple different articles, Rachel, and then I read about the San Francisco brief, I thought, I don't hear people really talking about this angle. So I just think it's important just to let people know, how did we get to this place? And then what changes can people expect to see? I mean, obviously it depends on the city leaders and what decisions they make. But is there any other clarification you want to make just so we can understand where we are right now and how we got to this place?
Sure. I think in terms of how we got to this place, it's really overlapped with just the housing crisis itself getting much more severe. Homelessness has really been going up since 2016, and especially in the last 5 and 6 years, the unsheltered population in the U.S. and on the West Coast has you know, just gone to a sort of unseen levels. And so that has created a political crisis as well as, you know, a humanitarian situation. And so I think it's just impossible to, when you're trying to ask, how did we get here? It's really wrapped up in the fact that the crisis, the homeless crisis has gotten so much worse. And so has then pressure on leaders to do something. And so there's been more, you know, attention and money spent and focus on how do we get people off the streets, out of this situation, but also at the same time that we don't have enough affordable housing to move everyone into. And there is a lot of resistance to certain homeless shelters. Some homeless shelters have no availability. Some do have availability, but they're with all types of rules that people feel uncomfortable with or don't want to go to. So we have this problem that kind of requires solving on a longer time frame than a lot of people have the patience to dealing with it. And that's created a lot of pressure. In terms of how I think this, what this ruling will mean, I think we're going to continue to see the same pressure on cities that we've seen over the last couple of years to act. I do think cities are going to feel a little more comfortable passing punitive laws if you want to. I mean, Missoula is a really interesting example. Just a couple weeks ago, they passed a much more restrictive camping ban that I think a couple that, you know, under the terms of overturning Grants Pass does seem, you know, legal. But I think a couple of years ago, they took a different approach that I think there's been more questions about what legally and constitutionally can cities do to clear homeless encampments. And I do feel like you're going to see politicians feel more comfortable that they're not going to necessarily be sued for certain approaches. Although there will still be lawsuits. And I'm sure Sarah can talk more about that. It's not like politicians have free reign to do whatever they want, but the threat of a Eighth Amendment violation was definitely a big fear that a lot of leaders had.
Right. And in fact, you write, and I hope people can take the time to read your piece because I think this is so important. You write about the Cicero Institute, an Austin-based conservative think tank that has been pushing bills across the country to ban outdoor homeless camping and to make cities liable if they fail to enforce those bans. We're going to take a quick break. That is Rachel Cohen, policy correspondent for Vox. We're also joined by Marisa Kendall, who covers California's homeless crisis for CalMatters, and Sarah Rankin, a law professor at Seattle University School of Law and founder of the university's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Today, we are talking about the landmark ruling affecting this country's growing homeless population. The six conservatives on the Supreme Court ruled that cities can fine and arrest homeless people for sleeping in public spaces, even if they have nowhere to go. The ruling says criminalizing camping in public does not amount to cruel and unusual punishment. After a break, we'll talk about where people are supposed to go if they are arrested. How long will they spend in jail? And then, of course, we'll also talk about the root problems of this growing crisis. If you'd like to join us, the toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Coming up on tomorrow's Media Roundtable, we'll discuss a ProPublica investigation about rural Republicans who say private school vouchers will mostly benefit wealthy suburbs, and they're pushing back. Then we'll discuss The Night Won't End, Biden's War on Gaza, an Al Jazeera Fault Lines documentary that investigates the killing of civilians by the Israeli military and the role of the United States. If you have a show idea or a guest idea, if you'd like to give us an idea about how you'd like us to cover the upcoming election, you can email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we continue our series on Supreme Court decisions by talking about the landmark ruling affecting the country's growing homeless population. The six conservatives ruled that cities can fine and arrest homeless people for sleeping in public spaces, even if they have no other place to go. If you have a question or a comment about this ruling, what are your thoughts? Where do you stand? What have you seen in your city? What changes have you seen? If you have ever been homeless and you'd like to talk about this ruling, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email yourcall@kalw.org. Today, we're joined by Rachel Cohen, policy correspondent for Vox. Marisa Kendall covers California's homeless crisis for CalMatters. And Sarah Rankin is a law professor at Seattle University School of Law and founder of the university's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Sarah, the one question we've been thinking about since this ruling is, are we going to see homeless people cited and possibly arrested? I mean, do you think that we're going to see very high numbers of people being arrested?
Yes, I do. That's already been the case. The criminalization of homelessness has been proliferating across the country, and that was the circumstance before the Supreme Court decision, because cities had such latitude to punish people. So the difficulty with that problem is that it's very difficult to find evidence of how frequently people who are unhoused are jailed or fined. And that is because most of the records that are that cities keep when police or law enforcement are arresting people or finding people don't have a reliable place to record whether that someone has housing or not. So, for example, we did a records request a while back, and a number of the spots where there's supposed to be an address either had nothing in it at all, or they would list the address. You might have somebody who provides the address of a shelter as their address, because people who are unhoused have no address. And so there's not a uniform system for keeping track of what happens to people experiencing homelessness. And frankly, I don't think cities have a lot of incentive to be more transparent on that issue. But what we do know is from talking with people who have experienced homelessness, they have been repeatedly they've been repeatedly arrested, and they've been repeatedly been issued tickets with fines for having no safe and legal place to live.
So how much time are these people spending in jails? I mean, to think about just what jails are already facing right now, they're overcrowded. I mean, we recently did a show again with Mission Local's Joe Eskenazi about people behind bars who are desperate to get out of San Francisco jails, even if the only option is state prison, because of overcrowding, understaffing, and the presence of inmates and with people behind bars with substance abuse and mental health disorders. I mean, there's so many layers to this. This is just such a crisis that people with mental health issues are being put in jails. And we know that some people who are unhoused also have mental health issues. There's just so many questions around this, Sarah. I mean, the first basic one is, how much time will people spend in jail?
Again, there's a black box quality to this, and I think some of that is intentional. You're absolutely right. I mean, this problem doesn't exist in a vacuum. It's really made possible by two major policy crises. First, we've got this escalating housing crisis. We have, for example, today, not just a critical shortage of affordable housing, but cities across the country lack sufficient shelter. We've got rising evictions, and we have a record high number of cost-burdened renters, where nearly half of all U.S. renters really struggle to pay for their housing. So it's really unsurprising that this year we also witnessed the highest homelessness counts ever. But to your point, we also increasingly criminalize poverty. Our country locks up more people per capita than any other nation in the world, including people who are too poor to pay fines for minor offenses such as parking tickets. So when financially vulnerable people get sucked into this vortex of punishment, that can include jail. It can result in adverse credit history, the loss of driver's licenses, inability to get or maintain employment or housing. All of those things are proven to make homelessness worse. You asked how long people will be spending in jail. What we found in a 2015 study is that people experiencing homelessness, the cities with higher rates of income disparity were more punitive in their enforcement of the laws. So you were more likely to spend a longer period of time or to get hit with a criminal charge if you were experiencing homelessness in an area that had a high income disparity between the richest and the poorest, than if you were somebody who was experiencing homelessness in a place that had a more narrow income disparity between the richest and the poorest. So the short answer to your question is it's very difficult to know, but based on the data that we do have, we can expect the criminalization of poverty to continue at record rates.
Philip has a few more really important questions. Would people be housed with violent offenders in jails and prisons? What protections would they have from others while incarcerated? Would their possessions be safeguarded and returned when they are released? These are just a few questions out of many that this heartless ruling raises, says Philip.
Yeah, that's a big list. The answer to the question about what sort of protections people will have no protections, no special protections. Jail is the most expensive, least effective form of shelter you can offer somebody. And that's, again, what this decision, what cities were fighting for, is the right to be able to send people to jail if they didn't have a shelter to send them to. So these are the sorts of things that people should be getting. I think the general public should be very upset because leading with law enforcement, these sorts of law enforcement-led efforts have been repeatedly proven to make homelessness worse and to cost more than providing someone with permanent supportive housing. So there's all sorts of reasons why I earlier stated in the article that you cited in the beginning that this really is new levels of dystopian sort of view of what may end up happening with respect to homelessness if cities can't start making more non-punitive, evidence-based decisions about how they're going to respond to the crisis.
Well, thank you for the questions, Philip. We've got a few callers on the line, so let's hear first from Robert in San Francisco. Hi, Robert. Welcome to the show. Hi, is Robert with us? Okay, let's go to David in Santa Maria. Hi, David.
Hi there. How are you doing?
Hi, go ahead.
I just wanted to point out the fact that I've been homeless for 13 years, and I've lived out of my Ford Ranger with my dog and my cat and survived, but it's been very difficult, and it points to the fact that we're dealing with a phenomenon which has to do with being landless. We're not connected to the earth and to the land, and I have no place on this earth to plant myself, and that's being denied to me by the modernity of our lifestyle these days. And this whole ban on camping is just like saying, no, you can't live in the past if I want to live like a native or be at home on earth. I have to live by these city rules and this worldly rules that are all based on corporations, and they're based on the people who have money. And if you're poor and homeless, if you're homeless, you're poor. And poverty and landlessness go together, and you're not going to provide housing for people who have no money. So until you can solve the problem of how you put somebody on the land and give them a place to work and make a living, you're never going to deal with homelessness. That's my thought.
David, can I ask you a few questions, given that you've been unhoused for so long?
Mm-hmm.
Have you been arrested? Have you had to deal with authorities telling you to move on a regular basis?
Well, the way to get around that is to move constantly. And once you plant yourself down on a city street or in a county street or whatever it is, you're likely to get ticketed or have some cop knock on your window at 2 o'clock in the morning.
Wow.
And they'll, you know, ask who you are, want an ID. You know, I'm bipolar. I have all kinds of issues. And if I get woken up at 2 in the morning, I'm not going back to sleep. They know that. And it's gotten better since COVID because they've taken more of a hands-off approach, but they still do it. And the reason I'm where I am is because I'm in a working-class community where the rich aren't here. They don't live here. And so I'm on the same level, but a lot of the people who are working every day, even though I'm homeless. And so there's more respect for people like me in a place like this because we're all just getting by.
But, and David, I'm sure that you have met so many people over the years. What do you want others, just to, listeners, to know about why people fall into homelessness and just how things have gotten so much worse in the last few years?
It's medical bills. It's things like that. Things that you can't plan for, that you don't have insurance for. I had an emergency appendectomy. It went haywire. I had all kinds of issues, almost died. And I ended up on, with $300,000 worth of bills. And the only reason why I was put on Social Security was because the hospitals and the state agencies work together so that they can get you on Social Security so the government will pay that bill. Otherwise, the hospital is doing work for nothing. And they don't like doing that. And the fact that I was a homeless, or at least technically homeless, I was a caretaker on a wild horse ranch, living in an RV, which made me technically homeless, they don't like that. They don't want you in the hospital. They want you out as soon as possible. And so that just led to more complications. But once that happens, once that, whatever it is, for some people it's diabetes, whatever, you're not coming back up. Unless somebody's going to help you out, you're going down, and you're just going to stay down there. And that's why they're all out there. I mean, it's not like it just happens overnight because they're idiots. It's because they've had problems, and their problems lead to the situations they're in. Sorry.
Wow. Well, thank you, David, for calling in. Would you mind giving Kevin, our engineer, your phone number? Because we'd love to have you back on the show.
Awesome.
Just because I think it's so important to really hear from people who are living on the streets to figure out what can we do about this, because we know that it's getting worse all across the country. So if you wouldn't mind, David, we'd love to have you back on the show.
Okay, talk to you later.
Okay, thank you so much for calling in. I think that I'm sure David's story speaks to you, Marisa. Well, all of you really, but Marisa, I know that you interview homeless people in California, and everybody has a story. And I think what David said about medical bills, I mean, that's a huge one. People not being able to afford a medical bill. One day you're fine, and the next day you're in the hospital.
Yeah, everyone has a story, obviously, about how they fell into homelessness. Often it's a lot of things that pile up. Doing this work, I've interviewed so many people, and I've seen so many people break down sobbing over their situation. And one of the things that gets people really upset is the, crackdowns by law enforcement. I've heard multiple people, start crying to me because, they're so sick of the cops constantly making them move, confiscating their belongings. They're getting arrested. I spoke with one gentleman in San Diego who was holding down a job, and he lived in a tent sort of in the woods by the San Diego River. And he was telling me, you know, when the cops come and clear out his encampment, he has to decide between going to work or staying and gathering up all his possessions so he doesn't lose everything he owns. And he's lost multiple jobs because he had to stay and clear up his encampment. So, you know, the constant arrests were just kept just pushing him back on his journey toward trying to get back on his feet. It makes it really hard. And when you talk to folks and you just hear their stories and see them cry, you know, it just makes it so personal and makes you really realize some of the damage some of these policies can do to individual people's lives.
You know, I wonder, we're almost out of time. How should we be talking about these issues, given that, you know, in many cases, city leaders, national leaders have really failed on this issue? I mean, it's just getting worse. There are many levels to it, but it's a medical bill. It's not being able to pay your rent. It is not, you know, maybe being evicted. I mean, there's so many issues around this, but we know that it's getting worse. And a lot of people clearly are tired of this crisis. I mean, you hear these stories that go national. This just happened in San Francisco. A 49-year-old unhoused man allegedly shoved a woman into an oncoming BART train at the Powell Street platform, and she tragically died. I mean, it was a horrific story. So we know that these things happen, and you have to wonder, so why couldn't this man get help? And so there's that issue. But then there's people who are, you know, maybe one paycheck away from being homeless, and then they might spiral into having a mental health crisis. So I guess the question is, how should we talk about this now that this is just such a crisis? I'm taking care of family members in Sonoma County. I've never seen so many homeless people in Petaluma and Rohnert Park. We talk a lot about the big cities, but this is also happening in small cities. So Sarah, why don't you go first? At this point, how should we be talking about these issues?
I think we should be talking about housing as a human right. Housing and a sense of belonging, a sense of home, is a fundamental human need. There's nothing more fundamental to our sense of humanity. Everything else stems from that sense of having a safe and legal place to exist. Home and community are repeatedly the most vital things, that we long for as human beings. So I think we should be talking about housing as a human right. I really appreciate David coming on to the show, and I appreciated Marisa's insights in terms of talking to folks. The way that we can really get there is by centering people with lived experience. We have conversations about people who are experiencing homelessness all the time, but the real experts are the people who are dealing with these issues. If we listen to them, and find out what it is that they need, what it is that's preventing them from succeeding, I think we will have better policies as a result.
Rachel, what do you hear from advocates about where we are right now and how we should be talking about these issues?
Well, advocates are really hoping to use this moment, this post-Grants Pass v. Johnson moment, to try to redirect the conversation around solutions that could solve homelessness. They want to take this opportunity, as people have, you know, there's been a lot of public education over the last couple of months with this case around, you know, reasons we are in this crisis, things that what might happen as a result of this case. And so advocates are hoping that people concerned about the issues will both speak out and start organizing locally and nationally around things like more money for housing, repairs for public housing, eviction prevention programs. There's a national campaign called Housing Not Handcuffs that they're trying to mobilize. Some advocates are trying to look at, you know, the playbook of abortion rights advocates after Roe v. Wade and say, well, why don't we push for state and federal protections that can help codify the rights that existed under Martin v. Boise. I think that's going to be a harder push because certainly Roe v. Wade was a lot more politically popular, but there is definitely polling and evidence that shows, you know, most people who do want their communities to maybe take more of an aggressive approach on homeless encampments, even they often say, oh, but I don't want them to go to jail. There's kind of this position where a lot of people want their governments to do something. They want action to be taken, but they don't really also like the idea of throwing people in jail. The problem is that's often what happens. That's often the result of these policies. But I think homeless advocates are hoping to sort of leverage this attention and concern that has been generated from the case and try to help steer it in another direction. And I do think this is a really important point. Though criminalization is, you know, is going to be easier now, it doesn't mean it has to happen. And part of whether or not it happens is what individual people in cities across the country say and do, and who speaks up and who says, no, we should do something else. And so I just think we know that communities have very punitive laws on the books all over, and that doesn't mean they're all being enforced. And so there's a lot of room for people to shape the next few years. And, you know, nothing is set in stone on what's going to happen.
Hmm. And Marisa, your final thoughts? We have about a minute left.
Yeah, so a lot of what experts I spoke to about this case really wanted to emphasize was no matter what the justices did in this case, it wasn't going to do anything to work towards solving homelessness, mm-hmm. right? You know, if you arrest someone who's homeless, they'll spend, you know, a day or so in jail, then they'll be right back where they started. But if you don't arrest them, that also does not help them not be homeless. So they were really emphasizing, regardless of what the courts do, regardless of what law enforcement does, what they really want people to be focusing on is getting housing for folks. So whether that's just affordable housing for someone who just needs a little help, or whether it's permanent supportive housing with extensive services for someone who has a severe mental illness, that's what we need to really solve the problem.
Well, we will definitely continue to cover this important issue. Marisa Kendall covers California's homeless crisis for Cal Matters. Rachel Cohen is policy correspondent for Vox. And Sarah Rankin is a law professor at Seattle University School of Law and founder of the university's Homeless Rights Advocacy Project. Thank you all for your work, and thank you for joining us.
You're welcome.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. And thank you for joining us. You can find links to the articles and the statistics that we mentioned. You can find more information at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Savannah Harriman-Pote for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. And we hope you can join us for our media roundtable tomorrow. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.